This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon. It's Georgia Hargreaves here with you from now until 1 o'clock. Now, very shortly, you're going to hear from Australia's peak cattle industry body talking about China's new tariff on our beef exports above a certain quota. And you'll also hear from the Federal Minister for Agriculture on the topic as well. And stay tuned because a bit later in the program, a young agricultural scientist in the Kimberley is going to be sharing a bit about why he's so passionate about the industry. That's coming up in the next hour. First, though, from sadness to anger, there's a mix of emotions coming from commercial fishers whose futures are now uncertain since the WA government's permanent ban on commercial demersal fishing came into effect yesterday. Commercial fisherman Jason Simone has no income security since his fishing licence was cancelled yesterday. He's yet to receive any financial compensation from the state government, and as you'll hear, Jason is angry.
I still can't believe it. As of midnight tonight, this boat loses between $3,000 and $10,000 a day. That's not my money. That's the crews. That's my land staff. That's the fuel company. That's where I buy groceries. That's where I buy packaging. That's all the money I put through the community. I don't put it in my pocket. Goes all through here. The local community. As of about the 3rd of January, my shop's not going to have any fish because there's no fishing. I've got a huge amount of customers to supply. Where am I going to get the fish from? What's next? I'm not sure. One thing I do know is for sure is this can only end two ways. I keep fishing, and I'm allowed to keep fishing because it's not a sustainability issue, or give me my fucking money. Because as of midnight tonight, I should be getting $4,075,000 into my family's bank account, and I'm not going to get a cent.
Commercial fisherman Jason Simone. He's from Southwestern Fresh Fish in Bunbury. He shared this video on social media the day before the ban kicked in. So that was a couple of days ago now. And the video has since gone viral with thousands of people viewing it, liking it and sharing it. I'm keen to hear from you on this today. 0448 922 604 is the text number. Have you received any financial compensation yet? Or have you crunched the numbers as to how much you would need? 0448 922 604 is the number. Let me know. It is 12:08. You're listening to The Country Hour. And as we've just been talking about, commercial fishing for demersal species is now permanently banned between Kalbarri and Augusta, with the closure taking effect yesterday. The state government has committed $20 million to a compulsory buyback of commercial fishing licences. But Melissa Haslam is the head of the WA Fishing Industry Council, and she says that figure is a joke.
Oh, well, I mean, we have fishers that are still really in a state of shock because it's all been so fast. Really, they were given 3 weeks' notice that their licences were going to be revoked and their business essentially was over. That's not a lot of time, and particularly at this time of year, for people to even wrap their heads around that and think, what am I going to do from the 1st of January to earn an income to pay my bills and feed my family? So there's a lot of distressed fishers out there at the moment.
And there's talk about compensation. What compensation, if any, have affected demersal fishers actually received as of today?
They've received nothing as of today. All they've received is a letter to say they can apply for some compensation. But that is only, as it's been described, a prepayment for any final settlement. Now, what we've been saying all along is that's not really appropriate because it was so quick. I mean, 3 weeks, there was no transition time. There was just nothing. That really should just have been an emergency relief payment for those who are going to struggle immediately. While all the details around compensation were worked through, the way that it's been proposed as a prepayment for any final settlement is that essentially that leaves fishers in the position where they're really snookered. If they're desperate, they need to take it, but by accepting it, they're kind of accepting the whole situation and the compensation formula that's being proposed without ever having had the opportunity to negotiate that, to question that, to challenge that. I mean, it should be their right to do so. And what's being offered is barely license value, and only to holders of the license, not anybody else that's impacted.
And in the short term, I guess you have fishers who are trying to pay mortgages or staff wages. So is this support, do you think it's enough?
Oh, no, it's nowhere near enough. It's nowhere near enough. Some of them have sort of been trying to do the calculations and they're like, this doesn't even represent the value of my commercial license if I was to just buy it on the open market tomorrow. Well, not tomorrow, of course, but, ordinarily. So they're like, this just doesn't compensate me for my loss. It doesn't compensate me for the fact this has been my life and was going to be my future. I don't know anything else. Some of these businesses are generational and it's knowledge built up over generations. And it's all just been taken away with 3 weeks' notice. It's quite unfathomable considering the whole situation was caused by the government. I mean, it's not like there has been some environmental catastrophe or something that has caused this situation and everyone's grappling with it. This situation has been caused by governments over years by allowing essentially overfishing by the combination of the recreational sector and the commercial sector, but it's not a fault of their own. The government sets the rules for how much they can take and when they can take it. Those rules have been wrong. So we're in this situation because successive governments haven't taken the steps necessary to ensure sustainable fishing. And our industry pays their license fees every year to the government to manage the fishery sustainably, and they haven't done that. Now they've turned around and gone, oh, it's not sustainable. Here's your 3 weeks' notice, so it don't take away everything you've ever known. These aren't criminals. These are people who just followed the rules that were given to them.
The state government has allocated $20 million for the compulsory buyback of commercial fishing licences. Would you be able to explain who needs to be compensated and who's most likely to receive money from that $20 million allocated?
Most likely the people who are going to receive money are people who own the licences. A lot of licences are leased. So that will be a whole heap of fishermen that don't own the license but lease it who will receive nothing. But they've still invested in businesses. They still have equipment and, they still have whole businesses, but they may own some licenses and lease some licenses. So they will receive nothing. Then there will be all the crew and the deckhands and the skippers. They are set to receive nothing. Then there are all the people in the processing facilities that process all the fish, get them ready and distribute them to markets. They are currently set to receive nothing. There's a whole heap of people impacted by this knee-jerk reaction that right now are set to receive nothing with 3 weeks' notice. The $20 million is completely insufficient. It should have been, in my view, somewhere in excess of $100 million. And given the government has caused this situation, they should pay for it.
Do you know how compensation amounts are calculated? How did they come to that $20 million figure?
They take what's known as a gross production value, which is the sale of their seafood at like a beach price, what they call a beach price, a bit like a farm gate price or something like that. And they put a multiplier on it and say, there you go, that's the value of your license. It isn't the value of their licenses. Licenses on the free trading market sell for a lot more than that. And that is just a license value. That isn't compensation for the business and all the, everything that hangs off of a business. So we can say categorically $20 million is completely insufficient. It's just a nonsense. And worse, from the 1st of January, when these licenses now expire because they're annual licenses, most of them, they've been told they have to renew their license and pay their license renewal fee, even though they can't use their license to be eligible for compensation. I mean, that's just rubbing salt into the wound. There's a lot of things right now that are being handled very, very badly.
You're listening to Melissa Haslam, who is the CEO of WAFIC, which is the WA Fishing Industry Council. She's talking about compensation offers currently being sorted for commercial fishing operators who are affected by the recent permanent ban on catching demersal fish between Kalbarri and Augusta. Now, Jess Baker asked Melissa Haslam if Pilbara trawler operators, such as Westmore and Seafresh, are likely to get any compensation at all. They have actually started legal action because they have also been permanently banned from catching demersal fish.
Well, there's been no mention of compensation, so we are in the dark at this moment in time. And I know the trawlers are sort of taking their own course of action to see what can be done for them. But there's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot more unknowns than knowns at this moment in time.
Melissa Haslam doesn't think permanent closures should have even been considered.
And there was nothing in the science that said, let's close commercial fishing forever. It was about, let's make sure we have sustainable fish stocks and then you can continue fishing on a sustainable basis. And you got to get that calculation correct. Just handing the whole West Coast over to the recreational fishers and banning commercial fishers forever, permanently, where on earth did that come from? I mean, that's the bit that caused so much shock through the industry. People were expecting some adjustments, people were expecting some change, but to be told we're closing you down forever, nobody saw that coming. And there were a whole heap of fishers that were drawn into that, like the shark fishermen, who didn't see that coming at all. So they were going along merrily. There's absolutely no sustainability issues whatsoever with shark. And suddenly they're being told they will be permanently closed. It's just been terrible. It really has.
In Queensland, similar changes are being phased in gradually through to 2027. And like we've been speaking about here in WA, the changes came into effect almost immediately. So do you think WA should have slowed this process down?
Yes, definitely. Or if the concern was so great, something had to be done immediately, there should have still been consideration for, but how do we ensure food supply into the future? Let's talk about that. Let's look at where there isn't sustainability concerns. There's lots of species that have none. And let's carve out some local solutions. That would keep our commercial fishers fishing, and that would keep some seafood supply to everyone who isn't a rec fisher. Not everybody is, you know, well-placed enough to own a big boat to go out in deep water and fish, you know, or want to. Let's maintain a supply of fish to our supermarkets, to our fishmongers, to our restaurants.
Beyond buybacks, are there other forms of compensation like quota transfers or access to alternative fisheries that fishers might be eligible for?
Well, it's very, very difficult. Most fisheries will be fully allocated or they're taking cuts themselves, so you can't just necessarily swap to something else. But this demersal ban, because there's sort of a handful of species that they're trying to rebuild the stocks, it takes into account a whole heap of other demersal species that are not necessarily at risk at all. So like I say, there would have been ways. I mean, we've got people down on the south coast who fish nanogai or bite redfish. There's no real sustainability concern there at all. There's currently a trawling of that fish from South Australia that has MSC, tick of sustainability approval. So surely if that can operate in the same water for the same fish, fishermen down there could have continued to fish that fish line and hook. And they've been shut. And they've been drawn into this. So like I say, there was a whole heap of things that could have been done differently, better, local solutions carved out. There could have been a supply, commercial supply of fish to West Australians. And it's all just been bundled into one decision. The solution was in how they handled this decision. And my argument is I don't think it is too late for that. I think if the government would come back to the negotiating table now, we could say, look, let us point to a handful of localised solutions that will keep commercial fishers fishing, that will keep fish supply to West Australians, and that will still go a long way to protecting the stock that you're worried about.
It's 20 past 12 on the Country Hour this afternoon, and I'm keen to hear your thoughts on some of the things WAFIC CEO Melissa Haslam is saying. The text number is 0448 922 604. Fishing is obviously a hot topic at the moment because recreational fishers won't be able to catch demersal fish between Kalbarri and Augusta until spring 2027, so for the next 21 months. And permanent commercial fishing bans on demersal fish came into effect yesterday. That's for any commercial operator between Kalbarri and Augusta, and also for trawlers in the Pilbara waters. 0448 922 604 is the text number if you'd like to get in touch. There's a few coming through already. This text in from Jim, who says, Georgia, is this fishing ban for real? Can the government tell us how many commercial fishermen have been shut down and who is going to replace the fish that are now not being caught by them? This is an embarrassment to the government and people of WA. Thank you for that text, Jim. And this is in from Jono, who says, after the changes to gun laws, Police Minister Paul Papalia told me to get another hobby. So I did and bought a boat. Do I have to get another hobby? What's next? Camping, four-wheel driving. Thanks for that text, Jono. And this in from Nathan, who says, this Labor government we have at both federal and state levels just doesn't care about Australian industry. Thanks for those texts. 0448 922 604 is that number again. But just getting back to the topic of compensation, Melissa Haslam says other commercial fishing operators are still waiting to hear if they will receive any compensation for regulatory changes introduced in the last 5 years, some in the South Coast waters and others in the Kimberley.
Now, a number of years ago, there was a number of marine parks put in the Kimberley, and these fishermen were supposed to be compensated for their loss. Some of those fishermen are still waiting 5+ years later. We have fishermen up there who have lost nearly everything, including marriages, family breakdowns. We have fishermen who are living on boats or in cars. They've lost everything. And 5 years on, they're still waiting to be compensated by the government. The next thing that happened was a big marine park was put in along the south coast. That marine park will take effect at the end of this year, 2026, and fishermen won't be able to fish. And that affects, between the Kimberley and the south coast, 331 licence holders, and the government has allocated $6 million. For the South Coast. It nowhere near in any realm of this universe comes close to compensating people for their loss. So we have fishers that have waited 5 years for a pittance. We have fishers on the South Coast who know they're about to lose everything, who have been watching what's gone elsewhere around the coast and have been allocated $6 million between all of them for all their business loss. And then this demersal ban has come on top. It's like we're starting to feel absolutely persecuted by this government.
And the compensation for the South Coast commercial fishers, has any of that been processed yet? Do you know?
None. None at all. So we have announcements on top of announcements and, you know, a handful of cake crumbs thrown at people for their loss. These people have done nothing wrong. They're not criminals, you know. The Kimberley guys are in the situation they're in because the government has introduced more marine parks. The South Coast fishers are in the position they're in because the state government has implemented more marine parks. The demersal fishers are in the situation they're in because the government has mismanaged the fishery to the point it's not sustainable. All of this is not the fault of the fishers.
Are you worried the same delays will now hit demersal fishers as well?
Well, I mean, the only difference there is they've offered that act of grace payment up front in January. But the problem with it, I mean, like I said earlier, is that should have been just immediate relief for the situation they've caused to these people, not a prepayment for a final settlement amount to come some stage later in this year, because that really binds people into a process that right now they don't believe in, and you can hardly blame them. You know, they've not had an opportunity to talk to anyone, to communicate what they need or what they require. That it's just been this sort of figure plucked out of the air by government that's being pushed on them and go, well, that is your compensation. Well, that isn't an appropriate compensation, and we haven't had the opportunity to talk to you about that or negotiate or challenge, which they should have a right to do in these circumstances.
So what's the focus now as we start this new year with this demersal ban in effect? What are you focused on?
Well, we have desperately been trying to get the government to come and meet with us. We had one very brief meeting with the minister just shortly after the announcement, but things were very raw at that time and very fresh, and we need the opportunity for the fishers to be able to sit down and have real conversations with government about what happens next, and to get the government to come back to the table and go, look, we haven't even spoken about if there are opportunities to keep people fishing. Let's look at that. Like, let's see if we can keep some fishers fishing. But let's talk about the whole situation. Come and talk to us.
Melissa Haslam is the CEO of the WA Fishing Industry Council, or WAFIC. She was speaking with Jess Baker after the demersal fishing ban came into effect yesterday, the 1st of January. And we have reached out to the WA Fisheries Minister, Jackie Jarvis, and we hope to speak with her soon about, you know, some of the concerns you've just been hearing over compensation for commercial fishers. It's 26 past 12. You're listening to the Country Hour today on ABC Local Radio. Now, Australia's peak cattle industry body says China's new tariff on Australian beef exports is disappointing. China will impose a 55% tariff on Australian beef if more than 205,000 tonnes is sent in a year. Other countries are also subjected to tariffs at different quotas. Cattle Australia Chair Gary Edwards says the tariff will disrupt trade significantly.
It's just a disappointing result that the great relationship that we have hasn't seen us treated more appropriately. We've been treated as one of a bunch.
AMIC is wanting to push for an exemption. Is that something Cattle Australia would support?
Well, clearly, that's something that we've discussed with our contemporary red meat industry bodies, that that we do expect, and we reasonably expect it to be treated differently to this, because the massive increase of beef imports that have gone into China over the last couple of years has really come from South America, and it's disappointing to see that Australia has been treated the same as those countries.
What impact do you think this will have on Australia's red meat industry?
Well, fortunately, it's unlikely to have an impact for several months. The earliest potential impact may be around May, June, based off current volumes, but we'll wait and see. Hopefully, that gives us time to engage in further discussions with our Chinese contemporaries and to hopefully moderate this position that we've seen imposed, because a 50% tariff imposition is a very blunt instrument. And that will very significantly disrupt trade if that is how it continues to roll out.
Does the Australian red meat industry need to improve its market diversification for when issues like this occur?
You know, Australia is fortunate that we have probably one of, if not the best, global market diversification in the world. And to be very fair, our red meat industry contemporaries such as AMIC and our service company in MLA does a great job of marketing our beef to, you know, in excess of 80 countries around the world. The challenge is where you have a large buyer of our product, such as China, and last year they took over 300,000 tonnes, and they choose to do something that's highly inconsistent with their previous discussions and certainly our FTA, that does come to a shock to the industry. It's very hard to say that we need more, because we've been doing a great job of getting that. It's just disappointing that the impact that's been caused from another part of the world is being applied to Australia, particularly when we have a very clear free trade agreement with China.
Do you know the types of product that go to China from the beef industry?
Well, there's an array of products that we send there from, you know, our lower cost, higher volume items, if you like, which is similar to the product that we send to the United States. But we're fortunate that there's big demand out of the US that will essentially swallow all of that up. But we also send a whole range of high quality, very well marbled product that goes into the restaurant system and in China. So China is a very diverse market. It's not a singular product situation, which is why it's traditionally been a great market for our country. But, you know, ultimately we will see that the trim and the lower end products probably go to other markets such as the US and other locations. The challenge will be where the additional volume that's been built up to service the China market goes for that high-end quality steaks and a lot of our grain-fed cattle that are focused on going to that China industry.
Cattle Australia Chair Gary Edwards, he was speaking to Megan Hughes. And Federal Agriculture Minister Julie Collins says there are serious concerns about the way China is applying the safeguard mechanism, but she doesn't believe Australia has been singled out in this new policy.
So what they've done is for all of their importers, they've done an average, and that what they've done is they've said, this is your average of what you're allowed to send into China, and then over that there will be a tariff reply. And we have been engaged for some time about the details of that essentially and what that might look like, and we've been working very closely with industry on this. We do have some serious concerns about the way it's applying, but we have not been singled out here.
Your government's been very vocal about rebuilding relationships with China post the COVID era trade war under the former government, though. But were you perhaps too overconfident in your diplomatic abilities, given that we're back here with tariffs on our beef to China?
Well, as I said, this is a global safeguard mechanism that's applying to
all
countries equally.
It's the same effect, though, isn't it, Minister? Yep.
Well, essentially, part of the issue here is that the averaging of the three-year period includes some of the time when we had those restrictions on. That's part of the issue here. And the way that it is being calculated. And that is, I guess, our concerns that we continue to raise with the government and with industry in China to see if we can't get some improvement in terms of our export quota limit there.
Yeah. Do you think Australia has a chance of negotiating a better deal than, say, some of the other countries affected by this over time, like you were able to do with tariffs on our beef to the USA?
Well, obviously, that also took some time, and this has been applied consistently globally. So we'll continue to put up our arguments and continue to work with industry, but we'll also continue to work with industry in terms of making sure that we have more markets available.
Agriculture Minister Julie Collins speaking to Warwick Long. It's 28 to 1, time for an update from the newsroom. Kelsey Reid is here. Kelsey, hello.
Hi, Georgia. WA police still hold out hope for the 32-year-old man who went missing yesterday at Ledge Point. Four men with snorkels went crayfishing around 10 o'clock yesterday morning, with the man reported missing around 3 o'clock. Police divers, drones and helicopters have been deployed in the search, as well as local marine rescue groups and private craft. Sergeant Michael Patterson says, with the number of resources deployed, he's confident and hopeful of finding the man. The federal government he is continuing to resist calls for a Commonwealth Royal Commission into the Bondi terrorist attack, despite more than 130 business leaders and prominent Australians calling for one. Signatories to a statement calling for the inquiry include former RBA Governor Philip Lowe and former Victorian Premier Jeff Kennett. Also making news, the Northern Territory government says it will introduce voluntary assisted dying legislation to Parliament this year. And in sport, the United Cup tennis tournament begins today at Perth Arena, with Spain taking on Argentina. Australia will be playing its group stages in Sydney and has drawn Czechia and Norway.
Thank you, Kelsey. It is 26 to 1, and still to come between now and 1 o'clock, things are starting to improve in Queensland's northwest, with floodwaters starting to recede. You'll hear from a grazier in one of those areas very shortly. First, though, let's head to the Bureau of Meteorology. Luke Huntington is here today. Luke, what's coming up in the north of the state?
Yeah, hi, Georgia. Yeah, so, it's quietened down since ex-TC Haley moved to the Northern Territory, where it is at the moment. So, but still, most of the rainfall with thunderstorms is still going to be occurring over the Kimberley, probably more likely over the northern parts. So, We're only looking at around 10 to 30 millimetres with storms, with isolated falls to 50 millimetres. And that's going to be the story sort of over that area over the next few days. So each day we're going to see showers and thunderstorms with those heaviest falls over the Kimberley region. And we're not expecting any tropical lows or cyclones in the next 7 days. The moles aren't really picking anything up. So we've got a bit of a reprieve for now. So the other areas of experiencing some showers and thunderstorms today are over the Pilbara, the interior region, the northern goldfields and the eastern Gascoyne, but little rainfall is expected over that area. And then the area contracts a little bit further north on tomorrow. So still showers and thunderstorms through most of the Pilbara, except for the western parts, all through the Kimberley and northern parts of the interior, with most of the rainfall again occurring in the Kimberley. As we head to Sunday, a very, very similar area. Right throughout the Kimberley, we'll see those showers and thunderstorms right throughout the northern interior into the Pilbara region, except for the far west and also getting into the very far northern Gascoyne. On Monday, still expecting showers and thunderstorms right over the Kimberley area, most of the Pilbara, northern interior, this time getting through the inland, most of the inland Gascoyne. And on Tuesday, Kimberley area again, right throughout the Pilbara, northern interior, inland Gascoyne, and then extending further south down into the Goldfields region. Again, most of those thunderstorms should be pretty dry, just apart from the Kimberley area.
And are there some more low-pressure systems on the way that could bring storms and heavy rain?
We're not expecting any low-pressure systems or any tropical cyclones in the next 7 days. There is a potential tropical cyclone early next week out at the Cocos Islands, but in terms of the WA mainland, we're not expecting anything in the next week.
Okay. How about further south? What's on the radar?
Yeah, so the south today, we're not expecting any thunderstorm activity for the southwest land vision today, so it's a pretty quiet day for those guys. Just a little bit of heat, though, just in the inland central and northern parts, getting up to around 40 degrees today. And then heading over into the weekend, it's probably more about the heat. We don't have any thunderstorms forecast for Sunday, and into Monday, it's really just the very far northeastern inland parts of the central West District, so very much inland from Geraldton and Kalbarri. If that were to occur, it would be dry thunderstorms. And heading into Tuesday, there is a bit of a higher risk through the northern eastern parts of the Wheat Belt and maybe around the Seven Gums area on that Tuesday. Again, there could be some dry lightning with those storms. And there is a weak cold front just passing by on Tuesday, so there may be a chance of a shower just about the south coast between Augusta and Israelite Bay on that Tuesday. And I did mention the heat as well. So we have a very slow-moving trough over the weekend. So much of the southwest land division is going to be very, very hot over the weekend into early next week, just away from the west and south coasts. So a lot of places getting into the low 40 degree temperatures, particularly through the inland central west, right throughout that Wheat Belt region, Great Southern, and then around that Seven Gums area. And that's going to result in a severe heat wave beginning from Sunday right through until Tuesday.
Thank you for the update, Luke. It is 22 to 1. You're listening to the Country Hour this afternoon. And Richard Hudson, can you take us through the rainfall totals, please?
Yeah, and it won't take long at all. It's mostly up in the Kimberley, which is what's forecast, as Luke was just talking about. But, yeah, since 9 a.m. yesterday through to 9 o'clock this morning, Signet Bay had 59 mils, Doongan 6, Drysdale River Station 9, Kachana 23, Kununurra's Checkpoint had 53, just a downpour there. And then some dodgy figures, I reckon, because the only other locations in the whole of the state to get any rain were in the Southwest Land Division. And supposedly in the Lower West, South Perth's Deeperd Station had 7 mils, but nowhere else got any. And then in the Southwest, Capel's Deeperd Station had 11. So I don't know. Unless they had some very, very isolated falls, I'd put a little bit of a question mark on those ones. But who am I to ask those questions? But just as far as fires go today, due to the risk of fire, a number of shires do have total fire bans in place. So that's Armidale, Chittering, Collie, Dardanup, Gosnells, Kalamunda, Mundaring, Murray, Serpentine, Jarrodale, Swan and 2J. If you miss those and you want to read the fine details, just again, search Emergency WA on the homepage, on the website, you'll find the total fire bans just underneath all the bushfire advices that are in place for today. It also tells you what you can and can't do during a total fire ban, including things like hot work and welding, which are not allowed. And it's your responsibility just to check to see if there's a harvest ban in place. And as far as I'm aware, it's just Wongan Balladju is the only shire to have a harvest ban in place today. Again, if you're unsure, if you're thinking of harvesting today and you're unsure, just check with your shire. But Georgia, have you noticed in the last, I don't know, week, you bump into anyone and the first question they ask is, how was your Christmas? That would have happened to you a fair few times.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, for Simon Kelsall, his answer, unfortunately, is our whole family spent the Christmas period fighting fires. Some of those fires were uncontrollable, and one ended up burning 95% of a farm he has near Boddington, about 120 kilometres southeast of Perth.
I was keeping an eye on another smaller fire that we'd had in a different location. And then there's obviously this other big one out in the bush, so I'd sort of go up to a hill and look out over that, and yeah, that one seemed to be cranking up. And most people had said, well, everything's okay, we're going away for Christmas, we'll have Christmas lunch and come back, or workmen and things like that. He was meant to be heading off and these guys were going to go as well, but I thought, well, I better stay around. And then the workman rang me and said he'd, because he's a fire captain of one of the brigades, Crossman Brigade locally, so he had a phone call and said that that big fire out there was going to be on our place in 50 minutes. So I rang my wife, Natalie, and boys, and they were about to go to Perth to go to Christmas lunch. I said, that'll be okay, you go, I'll be right. And then I rang them and said, we had a mob of sheep that we were worried about on a stubble paddock. They're about to get in the car, they said, no, you got to get over here, get the sheep in, put them in the yards, and then we've got to go out and man this fire. So they came over and we put the sheep in the yards, and it was getting bigger and bigger, so we were sort of a bit stressed getting them in the yards, and then went out the back to have a look, and she was fairly raging. And before long, yeah, it was in the pasture paddocks, and there wasn't many trucks out there. It was probably only three or four at that stage, including myself, and then they started coming, and we were spot fires everywhere because it was coming out of bushes, leaves, and you know, they were going 400 and 500 metres into the pasture, and unfortunately, I thought we'd have a chance of getting it in the pasture, but it'd burn a lot quicker and harder and faster than we thought. So a couple of times we thought we might have had it, but the problem was it was burning inside the bush, down the bush line, which goes the whole length of our farm, so it just kept hopping into the farm and on several fronts and became uncontrollable, really. And then the winds picked up and pushed it further and went across the river, and that's when went into Ray's place and then threatened the town of Boddington after that.
Hard to fight this one, like compared to other fires?
Oh, there's moments where the wind had change direction and you'd get a chance to get in, you'd get it out, and then it'd change direction and blow up a bit stronger, and then it'd go again. Sort of, there's times it was easy to control and times when it just blew hard and had to back off and get out of there and wait for the wind would change and you'd come in and get that. But like I say, we did have it. I thought we had it on a few occasions. But then the wind did come up.
Yeah. And what's on the line for you guys, like when you're fighting a fire?
Oh, well, your life's number one, I suppose. So, you go in and do what you got to do, but you back off from it when the flames get too high, or the danger of your vehicle catching a light yourself, and you just got to use common sense and trust yourself.
And the property as well, because that's your business.
Yeah. And we had a heap of stubbles there, which would have been nice to have been able to save, but, you know, at the end of the day, we'll be able to put the sheep somewhere else. But ideally, we would have stopped it in the pasture paddocks, but which we thought would be able to do, but it didn't happen.
Mm. And do you know what you've lost yet? Have you done like a bit of an audit?
I lost pretty much 95% of that particular farm has burnt. There's only a paddock and a half that we didn't burn. So all the fences in between, all that, some are newer ones that were galvanised and had the fire break along them or something like that, might be okay, but most of them that had tree lines on them, all the trees have come over and wooden posts are burnt, so a lot of fencing. And then there's trees out in the middle or falling out of ridges and in the paddocks that are just burnt and then fallen over, so a lot to clean up.
And I can imagine this would be a fairly emotional experience regardless, but this is also happening around Christmas time. Mm. And, you know, you've got the kids coming back to the farm as well. Can you kind of tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, most farmers at this time of the year are all a bit fatigued and everything leading up to Christmas, trying to get harvest off, which we were too, but we knew we weren't going to get harvest by Christmas, so we're still working hard. And then having these fires on our doorstep for the week and a half leading up to it put us on edge a little bit and kept us up as well. We had other things on our mind with that, I guess. So we were a bit fatigued. And all the kids, one son had driven over from New South Wales, so he just got home and basically put straight into the firing line. So all the kids haven't had a Christmas or haven't been allowed to go and have parties with their, New Year's with their friends because they've had to stay and help Dad fight fires, so they've definitely had an experience. Hopefully we can get a bit of a breakaway, which was planned in January still. And then come back and sort the mess out on the other place and work out a plan of what we're going to do. Probably going to have to crop it. We can't run sheep over there because there's no fences. So just work out, try and prioritise how we go about cleaning up the mess and putting fences back up and getting it back to production as soon as we can for next year.
When you say cleaning up the mess, what does it look like?
It's black, but there's a lot of trees down. And over fences, so you basically got to get a bulldozer or a big loader in and just everything needs pushing up and burning up.
Again.
And then fences put up, which, like everything these days, everything's just got so much more expensive, and so it's a big, huge cost now. And just the labour and everything to go and put it up as well. It's going to far exceed what insurance we've got there to cover it, I imagine.
Do you have a dollar figure for it yet, or not?
On the fences?
Just everything, I guess, or...?
No, I haven't got a dollar figure, but there's definitely a lot of fences.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm too scared to put a number on it because I like
totally
to get the number
fine.
Right.
That's all good, yeah, that's all good. It'll be, yeah.
Could be 100 to 200, 300, was about $12,000 a kilometre, and I just haven't added up the kilometres yet. It could be, I don't know, I'm too scared.
Simon Kelsall farms about 1 kilometre out of Boddington. He was speaking with Anna Cox about the fire damage to his grain, sheep and cattle enterprise. On the Country Hour recently, you would have heard their neighbours, Ray and Brenda Farmer, talking about losing 2 heritage cottages in the same fire. And those cottages were built by a great-great-grandfather. They were full of heirlooms. And they also lost a shed, a vintage machinery collection, and trinkets, as well as some stubble and fences. Sounds like an awful time. I'm sorry to hear that. It is 22 to 1 o'clock. You're listening to The Country Hour today on ABC Local Radio. I just want to get through a couple of texts that have come through. This is in reference to the conversation we were having earlier. You heard from WAFIC CEO Melissa Haslam talking about the permanent ban on demersal fishing for a pretty big stretch of the WA coastline. And she was saying the $20 million of compensation that the state government is willing to front is not enough. Melissa Haslam was suggesting $100 million would be a more realistic figure. This text in from Alex. Well done, Country Hour. Keep up the pressure. Without your expose, we would find that this would be swept under the carpet being implemented at this time of the year. Keep it up. Thank you, Alex. This text in from Chad. Unfortunately, our spineless Labor government, both state and federal, do not care about primary producers. Thank you for that text. And this one in from Les in Geraldton. Happy New Year, Country Hour. Happy New Year to you, Les. He says, the thieving... I don't know if I can say this on air, Les. I don't think I need to edit this one. I don't think I'm going to say that. I might get myself into some trouble. It is 21 to 1. You're listening to The Country Hour. Now, things are starting to improve in Queensland's northwest, but a number of flood warnings are still in place. North of Cloncurry, the waters at grazier Peter Haken's property have started to recede. But that's after getting 577 mil of rain since the 22nd of December.
It's been a wet 10 days or 12 days, so which is, you know, not quite as much as 19, but it's, yeah, that's our yearly average in that space of time.
Have you had much damage as a result of that?
River fence is obviously down, but generally we've fared pretty well.
When you say the totals were similar to 19, have the conditions been the similar?
The lead up to 19 was dry. We only had 7 mils for January 19, and then when, you know, when the big rain hit, we had 620 mil here for the 8 days in 19. Well, we haven't had that this time here anyway. The condition of the cattle is the other difference as well. This time a lot better order.
Do you know how the cattle have fared after this recent weather event?
We'll have very, very minimal losses. We're very lucky. Yeah, had a good fly around yesterday, twice. Yeah, very minimal losses.
Is there much water still around? What's it actually looking like?
There's still a lot of water. You know, most of the Dugal River is back in the main channel now. You know, there's still a lot of water running down roads and across the downs and that sort of thing. We'll be able to get around a little bit this morning just on the Red Country and start doing a little bit. But, yeah, it's still going to be days before we can really get out and do stuff.
What are you hearing from your neighbours?
Most people in this area aren't too bad, yeah, as far as losses go. But, yeah, the more you go east, Zara, the worse it gets. In 19, it was a lot more widespread. Like, there was the devastation was from Cloncurry, Mount Isa to Huondon, down to Winton. So it was such a big area. This time it's sort of Julia Creek and Richmond. The area is smaller, but it's certainly going to be as bad, if not worse, in some places.
Peter Haken is on Granada Station, which is about 90 kilometres north of Cloncurry, which is over in northwest Queensland. He was speaking there with Zara Margolis. Now, just north of where he is, there's a very tropical, it's very tropical and it gets a fair bit of rain at this time of the year, but their rainfall tallies for the last few weeks are still pretty mind-blowing. Sophie Johnson popped into a barramundi farm near Mission Beach, which is about 140 kilometres south of Cairns. Owner Ryan Sprague says his ponds have been filling up, but so far he has been able to cope with the overflow.
Over the last week, we've had approximately 1,100 mil, so it's quite a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, if we get a lot more with the ponds, you know, obviously they could go over, but we have mitigated the risks this year from, we've learnt a lot from the rain event in February this year, and we put extra overflows in. So this year was fine. We didn't lose any fish it was really good.
What happened in February?
So the ponds went over and we lost quite a few fish down into the creek. So, but this year, all good this year. So we've put extra overflows in and, happy days.
Yeah, and so how have things been on the farm? What sort of other impacts does the rain bring?
Well, I mean, we have a tourism business here as well. So we're a commercial farm. We sell about 20 tonne of barramundi a year, but we also are a tourism farm. So people can come in and catch a fish, take it home, eat it if they want, or catch and release. But at the moment, after 1,100 mils of rain, it's just a mud pile. So it does affect us. There's a fair few people in town for Christmas and New Year's at the moment. And we've had a few phone calls saying they cancel and that sort of stuff. But we did have some people brave it in the rain. There's a few people here now catching a few. And, we had people just stripping off yesterday in their jocks fishing in the rain. It was pretty fun. So, yeah.
Is there any risk of crocs here at the Barra Farm with the ponds in the rain?
Of course there is a risk, yeah. It's the time of year where the crocs go walking. We haven't had any here yet, and fingers crossed. But I do checks every night with a spotlight just to make sure, because we do have little kids fishing here all the time. So sort of got to be on the front foot with that sort of stuff. So, yeah, but yeah, so far so good.
That's good news then. We like to hear it. That was Mission Beach Barramundi farmer Ryan Sprague. He was speaking with Sophie Johnson. It's 6 minutes to one on the Country Hour.
G'day, this is Hamish McTaggart from Bidjemeyer Station and this is the Country Hour on the ABC.
Well, it's the start of a new year and motivations to change things up or even reinvent yourself are pretty high. Kununurra research scientist Darcy McCarty remembers the moment he realised he wanted to pursue a career in agriculture, despite having no family background in farming. It came after a colourful time spent travelling and working as a tour guide on the Ningaloo Reef.
I wrapped up school and just thought I better get out there and have a look at the world. So I travelled for a year and then I was lucky enough to work in Exmouth for a while as a tour guide, and then COVID hit and I thought, well, I probably should go back and get a proper job or just go career in industry, which I'm passionate about. So I got into agriculture, did a uni degree in ag science, and the rest is history. Been working in the ag industry for the last 5 or so years.
So where did your interest in agriculture come from?
Growing up rurally, I think it's probably where it came from. Grew up in the Top End when I was a kid and it was just always around it. And then when I was a little bit older, we moved down to the Adelaide Hills, which is another area where there's lots of horticulture and agriculture going on. And just love the combination of being able to get out in the paddock and enjoy the outdoors work, but as well as put your head down as well and do some of the analytical stuff.
You're back in the north now researching in Kununurra, and we have spoken previously about your work with crop byproducts and cattle feed, but can you remind us what exactly you are researching here in Kununurra?
Yeah, so we're looking at the cropping byproducts which are grown in the Ord region and integrating them with cattle feeding systems. The idea to make the industry more sustainable up here and be able to utilise some of those byproducts which might not stay on our shores or not be utilised at all.
So you said your upbringing might have helped shape your interest in agriculture. Was there ever an aha moment where you realised this could be your career path?
Yeah, I guess there probably was. I remember when I was sort of between jobs after I finished up working as a tour guide and was thinking about my next steps. I was watching a documentary and it had a component of agriculture and I just thought, yeah, that's the industry I want to be in. And I just thought, yeah, it's a place where you can make a pretty significant difference in the work you do every day.
Do you remember what the name of the documentary was?
It was a David Attenborough documentary, funnily enough. Big David Attenborough fan. Yeah, that's kind of random, but that's what it was.
So you were awarded a 2022 AgriFutures Horizon Scholarship. What did you gain from that and how did that help shape your direction?
Yeah, it was an amazing experience. I'd highly recommend anyone out there go and give it a crack if you're at uni studying ag. I gained so much from it, from meeting different people in the industry. You know, they brought us together once a year for the 2 years. So you get to meet your peers from across the country, which is helped me, I think, in pretty good stead. You know, I've already got mates up here, which I know from that program, as well as expose you to so many different things within agriculture, which you might not be aware of.
Do you have any advice for someone who's interested in ag but has no background in it?
I think the best, well, I'm a little bit biased because I didn't have a background in ag, but I think some of the best people don't have backgrounds in ag and they can bring really new and fresh perspectives to the industry. So take the first step, whether that be going to uni, going to TAFE, trying to get a gig on a station, becoming a farmhand, getting your foot in the door and meeting people and, it'll take you away.
Darcy McCarty, he's a research scientist at the Kununurra Research Station, which is where he studies the use of crop byproducts like cotton seed and meal in cattle feed. And you heard him there speaking with Jess Baker. Now, next week, Richard Hudson is having a couple of weeks off. Richard, what's the plan for next week?
I thought I'd do a bit of shooting and fishing, basically. That's a joke, by the way. Now, as far as the Country Hour goes, we do have a new up-and-comer who's going to be joining the team. I keep forgetting how to pronounce her name. I think it's Melinda Spaghetti. It's something along those lines. Anyway, it's a fairly confusing scenario as we normally have when the cricket's on, but leaving the Country Hour in good hands of yourself and Belinda, back as normal. So I'm hoping to have a decent bit of time down south anyway. It should be good.
Oh, very good. Well, I hope you enjoy your break, Richard. And that's all we have time for on the Country Hour this week. I can't believe it's Friday already, far out. I'll be back with you on Monday in some form. Have a lovely weekend. It's 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.